University in St. Louis with Clifford Will. He's been at the University of Guelph since 1965. He was elected... 1995, much younger than us. he was elected Fellow of the APS also in 1995 and received the Canadian Association of Physics Hertzberg Medal in 2005. His field of research is gravitational physics with a focus on black holes and gravitational waves. He wrote a very nice textbook, which, if you're not aware of it, is called A Relativist's Toolkit, The Mathematics of Black Hole Mechanics, which I would say from a pedagogical point of view is both a very accessible and a very original approach, probably quite unique amongst textbooks in its approach to general relativity. And he gave a course on general relativity at the Perimeter Institute, which is recorded and available on PERSA, should you be further interested in that. Today he's going to speak on electromagnetic self-force as a cosmic sensor.
Thank you, Lucien. It's an honor to be here. Thank you for the invitation, and thank you all for coming. So if I were in my classroom, and if this were my usual classroom, I would all ask you to come down so I could see you, but I'm not going to try this here. Who knows what effects would that would produce, so better not go there. I want to tell you something about the electromagnetic self-force, and I want to tell you something about cosmic censorship, so I think you know what I'm talking about. The self-force is the force that's acting on a charge that's created by its own field, and something that we know from in standard E&M when we think about radiation reaction effects, what's responsible for radiation reaction is the self-force acting on a particle. So that's one aspect of the talk. The other aspect of the talk is cosmic censorship, the notion that singularities in general relativity should be protected by event horizons, or also the notion that black holes should not self-destruct and turn into naked singularities. And I want to show a connection between those two things. Before I go on, I'd like to mention the people who were largely responsible for the work. So this is Peter Zimmermann, a graduate student at the University of Guelph. This is Ian Vega, a postdoc at the University of Guelph. And this is Roland Haas, who was a student at Guelph, has now become a postdoc at Georgia Tech. So Roland is responsible for, giving us a lot of numerical advice, and we use his codes to do the work. Peter is the one who actually did the work, wrote the codes, and actually did the calculations. Ian was keeping a close eye on Peter while he was coding away, and I'm the guy who keeps them miserable by asking questions like, did you check this, did you check that, what about this, what about that, what's that, so on and so forth. So just a bit of an outline, but I think I've told you all of this. I want to say something about cosmic censorship, and then most of the talk actually is going to be about self-force, and I'll go through some introduction and then some general statements about the self-force in curved space-time, and then describe the calculation we actually did in Reissner-Nordström space-time. Some of you have heard this talk before. I'm aware of that, so let me tell you first that there's a little bit of value added here, but very little. So it's basically the same talk, and for the rest of you, there's no punchline to the talk, so we're still in the middle of doing the calculations, so I don't have a punchline, but I have something to tell you anyway, I hope. So let me say something first about cosmic censorship. There's been a long discussion in general relativity about whether cosmic censorship, well, it's been formulated as a conjecture, and there's been evidence to favor the conjecture. There's been evidence to counter the conjecture. So there's been counterexamples to the conjecture. And I think among the serious ones are the three that are listed here. And historically, the first serious counterexample to cosmic censorship that was encountered was through critical collapse, the famous simulations that Matt Choptwick carried out in the early 90s. So I think you all know what he did. He considered the spherical collapse of a scalar field. That's what, you know, that's what he did first. A scalar field that could be prepared in a state that initially collapses, and there's one parameter that can be varied in the simulations that represents how strong the scalar field is as it's about to collapse. And the story is that, well, if the field is too weak, it's going to just collapse and disperse, and no black hole will be formed. If the field is very strong, it will collapse and form a black hole. But there's the marginal case right in between where a black hole forms, but it's a massless black hole, and in fact, it's not even a black hole. The critical solution at that critical point is, in fact, a naked singularity that happens to be massless. So that was a counterexample to cosmic censorship, because that was an example where a collapse of a matter field could actually produce a naked singularity. The catch here is that in order to produce that naked singularity, you have to infinitely fine-tune the initial data to achieve the critical solution. If you're slightly off in either direction, either you disperse with no black hole or you collapse into a black hole. So infinite fine-tuning is what's required to produce that counterexample to cosmic censorship. I think maybe a more interesting, more spectacular counterexample to cosmic censorship came from the black string. So now you have to go to five dimensions to produce this counterexample. And it's a very, very pretty thing. So you start with a black string, which is basically a Schwarzschild black hole that's been extended in a fifth direction as a cylinder. And you perturb it a little bit, and under certain conditions, that is, if the string is long enough, it's been known for quite a while, and one of the owners of the instability mechanism is in the room, it's been known that if the string is long enough, an initial perturbation will actually produce an instability in the black string, and you can see what it does. The instability is actually producing black hole beads that are connected by very thin filaments. And the cute thing about this is that the filaments themselves become, to a very good approximation, a brand new black string that's also too long and will also produce additional black hole beads that will be, linked by filaments. So everything becomes thinner and thinner, and eventually you end up with a whole string of very small beads, very small filaments between them. And according to my other colleague in the room, Luis Lehner and Franz Pretorius, the endpoint of this, according to their numerical simulation, will be a naked singularity. And I would say that's a very violent, very dramatic counterexample to cosmic censorship. Of course, the price to pay, and it's significant, you have to go to five dimensions in order to see that. As far as we know, in four dimensions, there's no mechanism like this that would also produce this kind of violation to cosmic censorship. However, there's this other scenario that initially was due to Huberny, Veronica Huberny, from the late 90s, who pointed out that it might be possible to take a near-extreme black hole. In her scenario, it was a charged black hole that's almost extreme but not quite, throw a particle at it and drive it beyond the bound that keeps it being a black hole. That's what I'll talk about most. That'll be the focus of my talk, and I'll describe this in more detail in a second. I just want to say that this scenario has been revived and generalized recently in the context of taking a rotating black hole, also near extremality, and throwing either a spinning particle at it or throwing a particle with angular momentum and driving that system beyond the bound that keeps the black hole a black hole, beyond the extremality bound. And just last week, there was another paper on this that appeared on the archive. So it seems to be a timely topic again. So here's the Huberny scenario. And I'll have to draw your attention here to the math on the right-hand side. Just to keep things simple for me anyway, I'm taking the black hole mass here to be my unit. So I'm working in units where the black hole mass is equal to 1. I'm only doing this on this slide. That's not going to survive later. And I'm considering a Reissner-Nordström black hole with a charge that's almost equal to 1, but not quite. It's 1 minus 2 epsilon squared, where epsilon, of course, is going to be a small number here. It doesn't have to be infinitesimal, but it has to be small compared with 1, 0.1 or 0.01 or something like this. So you were epsilon squared away from extremality, and what we're going to do is to throw an additional charge at it. Little q is the charge that's going in, And little q has a charge that's proportional to epsilon. So we're epsilon squared away from extremality, we're throwing epsilon worth amount of charge into the black hole. And if that works, we're going to have too much charge for the total energy that's available in the system, and we're going to be driving whatever that is beyond the extremality bound. And there's a couple more things that need to be said about how much energy I'm giving the particle and how much mass I'm giving the particle. But if I choose my parameters correctly, and there's a lot of ways to do this, we have a three-parameter family of scenarios in an open set, you know, a parameter set, that a parameter space that's open. So there are lots of ways we can do this. And bottom line is that by throwing my particle into the black hole, I'm producing a final state that has too much charge for the amount of total energy present. And because of that, the final state cannot be a Reissner-Nordström black hole. Presumably, it would have to be a naked singularity. Now, the whole game here is to make sure that after choosing those parameters, which guarantee overcharging, that the particle still goes into the black hole. And that's a very straightforward exercise in playing around with the equations of motion for a test charge that you throw into a Reissner-Nordström black hole on a radial trajectory. And these are the equations of motion right here. That's not terribly important. But basically, the kinetic energy for the particle is the difference between the red curve and the blue curve. And if you choose your parameters correctly, you can let the particle fall in. It will fall in and produce an overcharged final state. It's not known, of course, what will happen to the black hole if this were simulated dynamically. So the dynamical evolution of a black hole initial state to something which is a non-black hole final state, well, I don't have much of a clue, as to how it happens. But the point is that according to this analysis, where you consider the particle just to be a test charge in that background space-time, there's a contradiction with the final conditions and, well, what the state can be, what the space-time can be in the final state. There was a limitation, though, and I said it a couple of times already, so the analysis that Huben went through is based on the equations of motion that a test charge will satisfy. And what the analysis doesn't do is to incorporate the cell force acting on the falling charge. And it turns out to be important. This was acknowledged by Huben. I mean, she knew about this. What she didn't know at the time is what no one knew at the time is how to actually calculate the cell force. So she knew that the cell force would be relevant. She knew that the analysis would be inconclusive until you properly account for the cell force. But based on the incomplete information she had at the time about the cell force, well, she couldn't really conclude one way or another. And that's the difference between then and now. In the meantime, we have learned ways to calculate. We have learned how to calculate the cell force in those situations. And the calculation that I'll present to you in a moment is basically just that. Yep. She did that too. And if you try to do it with a shell, the beauty of this is that you can do it exactly using the junction conditions. You can, you can account for the cell force on the shell fully accurately, but it doesn't work. So there's no scenario where the shell will go in and produce an overcharged final state. It actually bounces back before that happens. So good question. Thank you for mentioning it. So the reason, it takes a little bit of detailed work to show that the cell force is actually important, but basically under this class of scenarios that Huben considered, you have almost equality between the gravitational attraction of the black hole and its electrostatic repulsion. It's a near-extreme black hole. The charge is almost as large as the mass, which means that the gravitational force acting on a particle is almost as large as the electrostatic force acting on a particle. And that means that by the time that a particle crosses the event horizon, its acceleration is actually very small. And in this epsilon counting that I introduced before, the acceleration that a particle has as it's about to cross the event horizon is of order epsilon squared. Epsilon squared means little q squared, and that's also the scaling of the cell force. And that tells us basically that in order to consider those scenarios, we have to account for all the forces acting in a particle, including the cell force, because they all come in at the same order and they're all important. So the main question is, well, what is the cell force doing? Is it pushing it out? Is it providing enough repulsive force to prevent the particle from falling in the black hole in the first place, that would be a way by which the self-force could actually save cosmic censorship. Or it could do the opposite. It could actually conspire to keep the particle from falling in. It could be an attractive force. And in that case, the self-force would not be a way of enforcing cosmic censorship. And perhaps we would have to conclude in that case that cosmic censorship is not to be expected in, even in 4DGR. So now we have to face calculating the self-force. What I'll do for the next 15 minutes or so is to, I'll play tricks on you. I will play with your mind, and you'll never be the same again. I want to make the point that the self-force is extremely unintuitive, and your best attempt to make a prediction as to even its sign can fail. So we have a choice here. We could say the self-force is repulsive and helping us saving cosmic censorship, or it's attractive, in which case it doesn't help us. And you'd think that we can make some, we're all very smart people in this room, that we could make some very, very good guesses, very good intuitive guesses as to what the sign of the self-force is going to turn out to be. I want to convince you first that you will fail if you try to do this. And there's no substitute, therefore, to actually do the calculation. So it's my way of selling the calculation that we did, but I think it tells a very, very interesting story. So let's do something very, very simple. So let's forget about Reissner and Nordström. Let's forget about the charge of the black hole. Let's forget about moving particles. I'm going to try to keep a particle in place just above a Schwarzschild black hole, and I want to know how much of a self-force is present in that case. Now, if I'm holding the particle in place around a Schwarzschild black hole, of course, I have to provide an external, an external force to begin with to prevent it from falling down. So I have to fight against the gravity, acting on the charge, pulling it down toward the black hole. So I have to provide that force. What I'm talking about here when I talk about the self-force is the little bit more that I have to provide because I'm dealing with a charged particle instead of a neutral particle. So let's say we do this twice. We do it once for a neutral particle, and all I have to fight for is the gravity pulling down. If I do it again with a charged particle, now I have to fight against gravity. That's the same force I had before. But now I have to fight against the self-force acting on a particle. The situations are not the same if I'm dealing with a charged particle versus dealing with a neutral particle. So when I talk about the self-force acting on the charge, I'm talking about this little bit extra above the gravitational force that I have to fight for to keep the particle in place. That's what I'm talking about. Okay, so how are we going to develop some intuition about this? How are we going to make a guess as to how it goes? Well, I'm going to import some ideas from the membrane paradigm because it seems to be a very good starting point to build some intuition about this. I'm going to imagine, I have my blue particle up here, and I have the electric field that's coming out of the particle, and the electric field lines are going everywhere. So I have the particle up here. I have electric field lines that go down the black hole, that go off, that go in all sorts of directions. So those electric field lines are just permeating space. And, of course, we know all about this. We know how to solve Maxwell's equations for a situation like this, even in Schwarzschild spacetime. I could choose to adopt the point of view that the electric field lines do not penetrate the event horizon. I could do this. I decide I don't wish to go inside to see what the electric field is like inside. I will choose to terminate the electric field lines at the surface of the event horizon. I can do that. But of course, if I want to do this and be consistent with Maxwell's equations, I have to come up with, a fictitious membrane sitting on top of the horizon that's going to be endowed with charge. And it's going to be this induced surface charge on the surface of the event horizon that's going to be responsible for determination of my electric field lines. That's the picture I want to build, and the membrane paradigm works this all out and convinces us that this is fully equivalent to the original formulation of Maxwell's equations in curved spacetime, even inside the black hole. We can do that. When you do that and you work it all out, you find that this fictitious membrane that's sitting on top of the black hole has some very nice properties. And in fact, you find out that it acts as a perfect conductor you know, that's basically what Maxwell's equations tell us, that this fictitious membrane is a perfect conductor. In particular, it tells us that this horizon has to be an equipotential of the electromagnetic field. And that's good because that tells us that all the intuition we have about conductors that we got, you know, in first year physics can be usefully imported here, and that should tell us the answer. And we know all about doing force calculations with conductors. We know exactly what to do if we're dealing with a spherical conductor. And for the time being, let me assume that we're dealing with a grounded conductor. I'm going to relax that in a moment. We know that the force acting on this charge due to the induced charge on the surface of the conductor is the same force I would get if I had an image charge of the right sign, the right magnitude placed at the right place inside the conductor. So we know all about this. We know how to do the calculation. One thing we know for sure is that the image charge has a sign opposite to the original charge, and we know that this will produce, of course, an attractive force. And when we work through the mathematics, we find that the force acting on this charge, the self force acting on that charge, will have a negative sign that tells us that it's pushing in, it's an attractive force, toward the conductor. And when we work through the details, we find that it scales like the square of the charge. It also scales like the radius of the conductor, which here I identify with the black hole mass. And in addition to this, it scales as 1/3 of the distance from the center to the charge. And if you were to ask me, or if I were to ask you, well, does this provide a pretty good intuition for what the cell force really is doing in my Schwarzschild black hole spacetime? I guess like me, you would be tempted to say, well, yeah, I mean, I would expect that to be, you know, to be the black hole answer. Certainly, I would certainly expect that based on this membrane paradigm intuition that the force should be attractive. I'll have a punchline for this in just a second. You may object, though. You may object to the fact that I'm using a grounded conductor as a basis for my calculation. And that's a little bit wrong for the black hole application because the grounded conductor will have to support a net charge in order to stay grounded. So the Q prime that I had in the previous slide is also, in the grounded case, the total charge that you find on the surface of the conductor. And that's a little bit bad for the analogy with the black hole because my black hole cannot support a surface charge. Remember, we're still dealing with a Schwarzschild black hole here. But I can fix this. Instead of talking about a grounded conductor, I can just get rid of that excess charge. And the trick, of course, is to put another image charge right at the center of the conductor that kills off basically the net charge that was accumulated because of this guy over here. And if I do that, well, I still have a surface of equipotential on the surface of the conductor. It's not zero. It's not grounded anymore. But now I have a nice uncharged conductor that seems to be a pretty good analogy to the black hole situation. Now, you've changed the answer a little bit because now what's exerting the force on the blue charge up here is no longer one charge, it's two charges, so you're having a dipole, and so you're changing quantitatively the answer, but what you're not changing is the sign of the answer because, you know, that negative charge up here is still quite a bit closer than the second charge over here, so it's really this guy that will exert the most force. But dealing with the dipole means that you've changed the scaling with the radius of the conductor, and you've changed the scaling with the distance to the center of the conductor. But what we haven't done here is to change the sign of the force. So based on this very, very compelling intuition, I would be tempted to predict that if I were to do the calculation for the black hole case, that I would find an attractive force. And of course, I wouldn't tell you all of this if that turned out to be true. And in fact, the calculation reveals a repulsive force. So that's example number one that says that there's something very unintuitive about this, and that you have to be very careful in order to put too much, you know, in order to make statements about the cell force. It could be that the actual calculation is really behaving very differently. The calculation for the black hole was actually done in the early 80s, first by Smith and Will, and then generalized to for Schwarzschild, generalized by Zelnikov and Frolov for Reisner and Nordstrom. And basically, the answer is pretty much the same answer you got for the grounded conductor, but with the wrong sign, with the opposite sign. And against all intuition that you may have had on this, the cell force is not attractive. The cell force is repulsive. That's what the plus sign here means. The cell force is actually pushing outward on the particle. And it's even worse than this, because when you go through the details, what you find is that the actual cell force acting on the particle due to the black hole has nothing to do with the first image charge that we would have thought might be there. It's not the force of a dipole either, because, you know, the scaling here clearly says that we're dealing with a monopole force. It's a monopole force that's created by the second image charge that's found right at the center of the black hole. It's a fictitious charge. There's no charge there. The black hole doesn't have a charge. But the answer for the cell force is exactly the same answer you would get on the basis of the conductor situation, as if somehow you had, you know, removed the first image charge that used to be here and only inserted the second image charge right at the center. That's the answer you get. You get a positive sign because this image charge has the same sign as the original blue charge. That's the answer for the black hole, the exact opposite to what you would have expected. You're supposed to go, huh? Well, you don't have to do anything very exotic to find something that also doesn't quite follow intuition. Let's do something very simple, completely non-relativistic. Let's say I have a charge over here, big charge Q over here, and I'm throwing a particle at it, and the charges are of different signs, so it's an attractive force. So it's a Coulomb force acting on this charge that's falling in toward the big charge. So that's a very simple situation. We know that the force acting on the small charge is the Coulomb force, and we know that it's, in this case, an attractive force. That's why there's a minus sign in front of it. Well, what's the cell force acting in this case? So we're dealing with, you know, non-relativistic flat space-time E&M. Speeds are low. No need to worry about relativity at all here. We know the cell force is going to be radiation reaction force. And the radiation reaction force is going to be the force that tells us that the energy is supposed to lose energy, that the particle is supposed to lose energy, because that energy is going off to radiation. So the system is emitting radiation here. We have accelerated charges. We have radiation being produced, energy being taken away from the system. Therefore, the particle should lose energy, and the agent to achieve this is the cell force doing negative work, you know, on the particle. So the cell force is producing, is doing work on the particle that comes with a negative sign so that the energy of the particle is reduced to give it to radiation. Well, let's do the calculation. We know how to calculate the cell force. The cell force is related to the rate of change of the acceleration of the particle. Here I'm rewriting this in terms of the external force. It's a very simple calculation. You find when you work through the details, which takes about, you know, two lines, that the cell force is actually in the direction of the velocity vector. The cell force is not acting as a drag force taking energy out of the particle. It's actually pushing in, feeding energy to the particle. And I swear that's a true result. The cell force pushes. The cell force doesn't drag. The cell force does positive work on the particle. It gives energy to the particle, even though we're also giving energy to the radiation. And I would say, again, we have something that defeats intuition, although in this case the reason for why intuition is defeated is just a wrong statement of, or, you know, a naive statement of energy conservation. The statement of work energy, of the work energy theorem in this case, is that, well, the rate of work done by the cell force would be negative if there were no other forms of energy in the problem but, you know, mechanical energy and radiated energy. So this would be the energy going off into the radiation, that first term here coming with a minus sign. But there's actually a second term in the statement of work energy that actually plays an important role and comes with a sign that's not definite. And in this case, we find that this can be positive and this can be negative, because the second term over there does the right thing. that second term, the total derivative term, tends to be ignored, or it tends to be forgotten when people talk about exchange of energy between a particle and its radiation field. And there are reasons why it tends to be ignored. First, because people tend to think about periodic situations, and people tend to formulate this, even though they might not say that, they tend to formulate an equation like this on average after basically averaging out the total derivative term and killing it off because, you know, the boundary terms are periodic. Another situation where you can, you know, you can ignore this final term in the work energy theorem is if you're dealing with a situation that starts in a static case and returns to a static case. Again, on average, you find that you have equality between the rate of work done by the cell force and the radiated energy. And if you're dealing with initial and final states that are static, then the initial and final accelerations are zero. And again, the boundary terms that are coming from this integral don't appear in the final statement. But if you want to make a pointwise statement, or if you are analyzing a situation like this where the initial state and the final state are not necessarily static, then it's in fact this term that plays a dominant role, and you can have a cell force that pushes and does positive work on the particle and have positive energy radiation at the same time. It doesn't violate any law of physics. Bottom line, though, is that if you're going to do a cell force calculation, you have to be very careful and you have to be very doubtful that any intuition is going to be useful. You may get very wrong with intuition, and, you know, in this game, I don't think that there's anything more wrong than getting the sign wrong for the cell force. Quantitative details are not so important, but if you're wrong by a sign, it can have, you know, a very dramatic impact on what you're trying to find out. So remember that in our context of cosmic censorship, you know, a repulsive cell force can save us, whereas an attractive cell force will kill us. And if I cannot come up with a good intuition as regards to sign, then it really means that I have to do the calculation. Keep in mind that this example I just presented you, you know, the example of one charge falling toward the other charge is pretty close to the situation I had in mind with the black hole. And if you were to use this result as a basis for an expectation for the black hole result, you would be tempted to say that the cell force acting on a falling particle ought to be attractive, not repulsive. So hold on to that, because, you know, that would be the expectation you would base, that you would, you know, get based on these, on this intuition. We'll compare to the answer in a moment. So we have to do a self-force calculation in curved space-time, and that's something that we've learned how to do really well in the last 10 years or so, even though the foundations for doing all of this were there since the early 60s. Now, the reason why we ended up making a lot of progress in the last 10 years is not because we wanted to solve this problem. There were other, you know, considerations that we were given to the cell force, and that was in the context mostly of the gravitational cell force. So there's a group of us in the last 10 years or so who have gotten really serious about, you know, finding the motion of a small body moving around a large black hole in a description where you don't say that the small body is moving as a geodesic, you know, as a test body on a geodesic in the geometry of the big black hole, but we want to go beyond that. We want to account for small mass ratio corrections to this. We want to calculate how the small body affects the space-time around it and how the deformations in the space-time affect the motion of that small body. We want to calculate the motion to better accuracy. We want to calculate the gravitational waves that these systems are emitting. So all this modeling effort in that small mass ratio limit involve basically doing what I'm describing here for the electromagnetic cell force in the context of the gravitational cell force. But gravitational cell force is very difficult, so we had to work very hard, and along the way it was very useful to start thinking about simpler problems for which we could make more progress more quickly. And there are basically two types of examples we always go back to. Either we talk about a scalar particle having a scalar charge producing a scalar field and the field acting back on the particle. That's the simplest example of a scalar cell force. the electromagnetic cell force is one, and when we learn, you know, how to deal with these things, well, we usually are a good way along knowing what to do with the gravitational cell force. But it's really cool when you, you know, start playing with toy problems. It's really cool when you find an application that's also very interesting in its own right, and that's what I'm talking about here. So to do a calculation of the cell force in curved spacetime, well, as I told you, there was a formal answer to that problem given by Bryce DeWitt and, I forget his first name, Bream in the early 60s. And they wrote down this, you know, rather magnificent looking equation that no one can do anything with. And because of that, there's been very little progress actually dealing with this equation and extracting any, you know, concrete information from it. And the reason why it's so difficult to deal with is because this equation tells us that to calculate the cell force acting on a particle, well, first, you can do it, you can calculate some of it by just looking at local contributions to the cell force, the same ones, for example, you would get in flat spacetime, something that comes directly from curvature. But the other part of the cell force comes from a non-local tail integral that involves the entire past history of the particle. That's what this integral, my pointer is not cooperating very well, but this integral over there is really an integral over the past history of the particle up to the current time where you're trying to evaluate the cell force. And in order to know what you have to integrate, you have to calculate the retarded Green's function for the electromagnetic field in your curved spacetime. And that's where it gets really hard. It's very hard to calculate the Green's function, even doing mode decompositions and things like that, because intrinsically the Green's function is a distribution. It has all sorts of singularities in it, and those singularities make practical evaluations of it very, very difficult. And even though it's very nice to stare at this, it's a very poor starting point to actually do a calculation. Steve Detweiler and Bernard Whiting basically at the turn of the century, turned this into a much more practical way of doing things. And they did something that looks very simple, but that was really the key to turn this into something that could be done. And the ideas, I think, are very simple. The particle is producing a retarded field that, of course, is singular on the particle, and if you're trying to evaluate the cell force acting on the particle, you have to know how to deal with this singularity. So they told us how to deal with it. You take the retarded field and you split it into a singular field that carries all the singular stuff but exerts no force, and a regular field that is perfectly smooth and is entirely responsible for the cell force. It sounds too good to be true, but it's actually what they told us to do, and in fact, they told us exactly how to do it. Now, the singular field, of course, you can do it in all sorts of different ways, but their singular field has very, very specific properties that makes it unique. First of all, the singular field is sourced by the particle, and that pretty much guarantees that its singularity structure is exactly the same as the retarded field, because the retarded field also is sourced by the particle. In addition to that, because we knew what the answer is, we can verify that this cell, the singular field, exerts no force on the particle. So if we figure out what it is, the singular field, we can just remove it away from the retarded field, and what's left over is a regular field that is completely, responsible for the cell force. The regular field has also its own properties, and for one thing, it's actually a free field. It's not sourced by anything, at least not anything that's close to the particle, and that's the reason why it's actually very smooth on the particle, so we can calculate it very easily and then take a limit to the particle. The equations of motion then say that the cell force acting on a particle is generated entirely by this regular field. Just a few more words. If I'm looking at the field produced at this field point X over here, and the field is sourced by the particle moving on this word line, this is a space-time diagram where time goes up. If I were to construct the retarded field, I would find that the retarded field at X depend on the past history of the particle all the way up to this retarded point right here, the one that I'm calling Z of U. The singular field doesn't depend on the past history. It doesn't depend on the future history. It's, in fact, in a space-like relation with the field point X. The singular field is sourced by the particle, but only the portion of the word line outside the light cone matters. Outside and on. It turns out that there's a contribution from the past light cone and the future light cone. The regular field, then, is going to be the difference between the retarded field and the singular field, and that formally is sourced by the particle, but it includes the past history up to the future advance point over here, the one that I'm calling Z of V. So it's a funny construction where you're sort of importing a little bit of knowledge from the future, but it's very limited knowledge from the future, and by the time you're done taking the limit where X goes to the word line, that future dependence just goes away. The most important part is the fact that the self force, the singular field, is actually something that can be calculated locally around the particle, and in fact the Detweiler-Whiting prescription tells us exactly how to do that. So we know how to express the singular field as an expansion in powers of the distance to the particle, starting, of course, as 1 over r squared, because mostly it's a Coulomb field, corrected by curvature, corrected by acceleration, corrected by all sorts of things. But it's a known thing locally. It's known as a local expansion, and that means that we can start from the retarded solution, remove this, which we know, and then perform the rest of the calculation, which involves only a smooth regular field and calculate the self force this way. That was the basis for a lot of practical calculations, and of course we have a story like this to tell for the gravitational self force also. So the actual calculation of the self force that I want to do here in this objective to try to say something about cosmic censorship is where you turn this into a practical scheme in Reissner and Nordström spacetime. And here there's a very well-defined sequence of steps that you can follow that will get you the self force in the end. It's heavily numerical in what you have to do, but it's very straightforward. So first of all, we're dealing with Reissner and Nordström, so we're dealing with a spherically symmetric background, so that helps us because that means we can decompose everything in spherical harmonics. And we end up with variables that depend only on time and on the radial coordinate, and those equations for those variables we can solve very simply using a time domain code that's written as a finite difference code. And one feature of the code that Roland gave us that we've been using is that we're dealing with a point particle, but we don't, we're dealing with a point particle, essentially exactly the finite difference scheme accounts for the delta function source exactly. We don't have to smear the particle. We don't have to make a model for it. We are serious about modeling a point particle in our implementation. What we calculate then are YLM modes of our electromagnetic field from which we would like to extract YLM modes of the self force and eventually, of course, sum that and recover the full self force by mode summation. So the procedure is very straightforward, but remember that most of what we're constructing is actually a singular field. So the retarded field is a singular field plus a smooth field. And we know how to remove the singular field thanks to Steve and Bernard. What we had to learn to do on top of this is how to do it mode by mode. So when we calculate the mode of the retarded field produced by the particle, well, we look at the mode and we don't know before we do a lot more work which part of this is actually making up the singular field and which part of that is actually the smooth regular field that we're trying to find out. But knowing a lot as we do about the singular field, we know how to do it mode by mode. We know how to do a spherical harmonic decomposition of the singular field. We know how to remove mode by mode the contribution to the singular field so that what's left over is a perfectly smooth regular field, which is going to be responsible for the self force after we're done with doing the mode summation. In practice, of course, we calculate things up to a maximum value of L, the spherical harmonic quantum number. In practice, we go all the way up to L equals 15 or 20, something like this. But we know a little bit more, so we can actually estimate the higher contributions from higher modes. We have tricks to do this. And what's good about this is that we have so many tricks and so many checks and so on and so forth that all of this ends up being a very, very robust check on the numerics. So basically, if none of this works, you know, it all you know, if things don't work out as expected, you know that you've made a mistake in your numerics and you can go and fix it. And when things start to behave as they should, I'm going to show you what I mean by that. Well, you haven't guaranteed that you haven't made a mistake, but at least you're much more confident. So at this point, I can claim that we have some confidence that our numerical results are accurate. Here's what I mean by mode sum regularization. This is, you can't see this, but this is R squared times the electromagnetic field, so the radial component of the electric field multiplied by R squared, calculated at the position of the particle as a function of multiple orders. So this is L going from 0 to, in this case, 40. That's a simpler case. We could do this for higher values of L. The modes of the retarded field are the ones you see up here in blue. And you know right away that if you were to try to sum this, you would get a diverging result. In fact, all of those modes increase linearly with L. And that's not surprising because the mode sum returns the retarded field evaluated at the particle, and that's infinite. So the mode sum has to diverge because the physical field at the position of the particle is infinite. Each mode is well defined. It's just that the mode sum is completely, not convergent. We do regularization in several stages. And at the end of the first stage, we end up with a mode sum that's still divergent because now the mode structure, instead of increasing linearly, has become flat in L. But that's still not something we can sum. But if we keep on regularizing based on more and more information about the singular field, we can turn these mode sums that do not converge into this one or that one, and this one converges, and it converges rather rapidly to the self-force. So basically, after each round of regularization, you end up with a better and better approximation of the regular field evaluated at the position of the particle, and you get the full effect by basically summing over all those modes that you have and then making an estimation of what you're missing by not summing all the way up to infinity. Well, whatever punchline I have is this. I don't expect you to be able to read out all the curves, but I'm expecting you to infer something about the sign of the force. What I'm plotting here is the radial component of the self-force. That's the only component we've got here. On a particle that falls toward a black hole, that falls toward a charged black hole, But what's important to keep in mind here, and what I should have told you maybe a little bit before, is that I'm not talking about Hubini trajectories here. I'm talking about particles that, for mostly our own technical reasons, we've chosen to start from rest, and we let them fall in toward the black hole and picking up speed along the way. So if we were talking about Hubini trajectories, we'd be talking about particles that you throw at the black hole with a large initial velocity, and it keeps falling in with a large initial velocity as it keeps falling in toward a black hole. Here, we start them from rest mostly for technical reasons. We wanted to do something first that we knew we could understand and explore fully before we stuck our neck out and did something for the Hubini trajectories. So this is a particle that we start, I think, at R equals 50, way out here. It starts from rest, falls toward the black hole, picks up speed as it's falling toward the black hole, and those black holes have a charge of either in units where the black hole mass has units of 1, either 0.1, that's the red curve, 0.3, 0.5, 0.7, or 0.9. Well, all the curves are mangled together. I'll present this in a different form in a moment. But you're supposed to see here that all those numbers are positive. And that's the punchline I have for you today. The self-force that we're calculating comes with a positive sign. That means that it's repulsive. It points out. So the particle falling in feels, of course, the attractive force of gravity, the repulsive force of the black hole, and the repulsive force of its own self force. That's what the sign of the self force means here. And the sign is not something that we knew how to predict, right? I mean, I think I've convinced you that it's very dangerous to try and predict a sign and have any confidence in your prediction. Your intuition can go badly wrong. In the non-relativist example, it was the opposite sign. It was an attractive force. Here, it's a repulsive force. We had to do the calculation to know. Here's another way of displaying the data that sort of separates the curves. And the way to separate the curves is to just factor out what is probably the main scaling of the self force with the radius, with the distance to the black hole. So instead of plotting the force here, I'm plotting R cubed times the force. And that's a useful thing to do because numerically we expect the curves to flatten out as we go to large distances, and they seem to be doing this. And here the particle is starting from R equals 50, so I'm showing you quite a bit more of the plot than I had before. Before I was starting, I was showing the plot up to R equals 20. Now I'm going all the way to R equals 42 or something like this. There's a reason why I'm not showing you the rest of it. You don't want to see it. You can ask me what I'm hiding. I'll tell you, but I won't otherwise. You can take a hint here that, you know, we're not controlling fully what's going on at the largest distances, but I can tell you why if you want to know. But basically, here's the answer. So we have, again, positive numbers over here, so it's a repulsive self force. Here's the curve for Q equals 0.1, the red curve. The green curve is 0.3. Blue is 0.5. Cyan is 0.7, and the highest curve over here is Q equals 0.9. We have no obstacle going to higher values of Q, it's just that we haven't done it for this plot. Two things to say about this. One, I've said before, we are dealing with a repulsive force, and that's good news for cosmic censorship. The other thing that's good news for cosmic censorship is the fact that the self force is actually increasing with the black hole charge. So it's acting in the right way, and the strength of the force increases with how much charge you have at the center. And that's telling me that modulo the fact that I'm not doing the calculation for the right type of trajectories, those Huberty trajectories, I'm still a step removed from doing this, this is pointing in the right direction. This is pointing to the fact that there's a good fighting chance that the self force acting on the charged particle falling in toward the black hole will prevent the particle from crossing the event horizon. It will turn it around first because it's acting in the right direction and, you know, more so as you start increasing the charge. So I'm basically done. I think I've told you what I wanted to tell you. A couple of messages. First message is that while self forces in curved space-time are very tricky, very non-intuitive, and I think you do have to do the calculation in order to know what it's going to do. I hope I've convinced you that intuition can fail and even produce the wrong sign, which is all, you know, which is really the most important thing, at least for this application. We've done the calculation, very detailed calculation, for not the type of orbits that are, not the type of trajectories that are immediately of concern in the Huberty scenario. Just for our own purposes, we decided to solve the case where the particle starts at rest. We felt we could control this better, but we have no obstacle in principle to start the particles with a high speed and start them with the right parameters to give rise to Huberty trajectories that would, you know, penetrate the black hole and overcharge it if it were not for the self force. I think we know how to do that. It's just that we have to do it. Each calculation is not that, you know, those calculations are not that long to do. It's just that we want to be sure we're doing the right thing, and we still have some, a little bit of, you know, sorting out to do just for this case before we're ready, before I'm confident that we can say something in the Huberty case. But given the evidence we have now, given that we have a repulsive force and a force that increases with the black hole charge, I feel pretty, well, I would say that I'd be willing to spend some money and bet on the outcome that this is really the agent that's required to save cosmic censorship from the Huberty scenario. But of course, after all the warnings that I gave you about not relying on intuition. I don't want to say for sure until I've done the calculation and checked it once and checked it again and checked it the third time in order to conclude. So that's where we stand. We have to carry on with the work. And, well, hopefully you'll hear about it soon and you'll know what the real answer is in due course. Thank you for your attention.
Do we have questions?
So, did anyone try to do a similar calculation but with fields, like just send some small wave packets or some charge field and do the simulation like Luis does in his simulation?
Not to my knowledge. So I think it would be very interesting to do to start with a wave packet, to start with, you know, let's say a charge scalar field, so, you know, a complex scalar field, put it in a small wave packet and see what happens. I think there you have much more opportunity, though, to disperse the particle and to disperse the field before it gets down to the black hole, and then basically whatever penetrates is going to be just a small fraction of whatever was there in the first place. So I think there's much more room here to enforce cosmic censorship if you're not forcing the particle to stay a particle. So I think it would be interesting to do it. I don't think anyone has done it, and it's certainly something that could be done, especially if you're, you know, doing this as a test scalar field in a spherically symmetric background. I think there would be no obstacle in doing this, but as far as I know, it hasn't been done.
So you showed a sequence of different curves for different degrees of extremality.
Yep.
Of the black. Can you see from what you have done so far whether it saturates at some curve or what kind of behavior you're going to get as Q approaches M?
So what we cannot do is to let Q being be equal 1, because, you know, there are some things in our code that are hardwired that would not allow us to take the pure extreme limit. But we've written the code in such a way that there's no obstacle in pushing Q to be as high as possible short of being equal to 1. And it does seem to saturate, so it doesn't, you know, it doesn't diverge. So it certainly it stays finite and well defined, and not, you know, and you know, all the way through, all the way to Q equals almost 1. So I think I'm answering yes to your question. So yes, it does, you know, it does asymptote to a finite limit.
So, Eric, one question. So if I look at large radius, I mean, as you said, that as larger you have higher and higher charges, the force points in the right way. But if I look at low radius, it seems to take a nosedive. And, I mean, it's getting dangerously going towards zero, right? So if I were to look at 0.99, then yep. Could there be a situation where the nosedive is violent enough and eventually will close to zero, will cross zero very close to R equal to M?
We haven't seen this. Of course, we can only approach it so far, but a virtue of this is that, you know, when it stops, it's because you've reached the event horizon. I mean, we're extremely, extremely close to the event horizon, so there's no evidence, as far as I can see, that this goes all the way down to zero. Even if it were to go down to zero, which it doesn't, but even if it were, what we want the cell force to do is to create a turning point. So it's not so much the value at any point that matters, it's the accumulation of what it does as the particle keeps going down. So it's the continued action of a self-force that eventually will produce a turning point. And beyond that, it doesn't matter whether the self-force keeps on going, because you're already, you know, you're already coming back.
Right, but I mean, then you can play the Huey game and start sending things at faster and faster velocities, and maybe the two combined can give you a little bit of a window for violating.
Yeah, that's right. So a challenge for us is to find a way of sampling the parameter space, which is open and infinite, in a satisfactory way that would say, well, we'll never prove that all scenarios are invalidated this way, but at least here's the evidence we have in favor of there always being a turning point before the particle goes in. So my conjecture is that this is what we'll be able to show, but, you know, we still have the work. We still have to do the work.
No questions.
one other question. How does this cell force compare to the one you showed us before if the particle were at rest?
The main reason why we wanted to start with particle at rest is that we wanted to be able to connect the static calculation with the dynamical calculation, at least at early times where the particle is still at rest. The R cubed behavior that you see here, the fact that the curve seemed to be leveling off at one, is telling us that we're seeing the right thing coming out. So the comparison is working out. But we're not done doing this yet, because the problem with the calculation as it stands is that we haven't done a very good job at imposing correct initial data for the simulation. And the wiggles in the red curve that you see is basically an artifact of this. So the next thing we need to do before we move on is to do a better job with initial data, do this comparison, convince ourselves that we understand this, and then move on and show that, well, basically that's convincing us that we know how to do the calculation, and then we can move on to the Hubini case.
Does that mean we should not conclude from this that the force is less than the rest force?
I'm sorry, what?
Well, does that one mean that the force would be exactly equal to the force
so,
at rest?
Yeah, that's right.
So this is saying that the motion actually diminishes the force,
yep,
if we believe this curve.
It does.
So if you threw it in, it might even diminish the force more, so that's going in the wrong direction. Is that right?
The question is, well, how much do you diminish it? And here we see, well, maybe 40%, maybe 50%. And then, of course, we have to decide whether that's enough to continue, to give a turning point or not. So there's some quantitative aspects that need to be worked out.
Any more questions? Okay, well, let's thank Eric once again.
Thank you.